Hello and welcome to Novara FM, brought to you by Novara Media and broadcast live on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's very finest radio station. I am James Butler. As I'm sure everyone knows, Novara Media was down at the Labour Party conference last week as Brighton was racked by petty intrigue and gossip. Tom Watson plotted, and some genuinely extraordinary policy was passed, including but far from limited to the Green New Deal plan. And we'll be breaking down the highs and lows, the victories and the troubles throughout this show. To do so, I am joined by the ever-incisive James Meadway, former advisor to the Shadow Chancellor and long-term friend of the show during the political turbulence of the past few years. I'm also joined by co-director and policy guru of the Labour for a Green New Deal campaign, Adrian Buller. Now, Adrian, I assume for the last few days have had a bit of a glow to them after the Green New Deal passed at conference.
Yeah, absolutely, although mostly a glow of exhaustion more than anything else.
I think we all feel that. And I hear, James Meadway, little birdie tells me that you've somehow managed to produce a book in between everything else you've been doing.
I wish I had. I mean, I've almost produced a book. It'll be written before the election is my current target.
Well, even that's envying productivity, let me tell you. Okay, I mean, we should dive into some of the stuff that was going on at conference. I wanted to talk about first sort of the politics of policy in some way. And I just, is it the first conference of the Corbyn era where radical policy that has been generated by members has passed and even dominated the political conversation? I guess, is that a blip or does it change the way that Labour operates?
Yes, it is. I mean, the previously, what has happened is the leadership, basically, one way or the other, has come up with something quite big, and conferences has sort of done a thumbs up for that, and then we've moved on. What's happened this time around is that quite actively, people have got out Labour Party members, so Labour for Green New Deal, Labour for 4-Day Week, Labour Campaign for Free Movement, the various sort of campaigns have got together, organised themselves, and pushed for policy. In particular, winning motions at constituency Labour Party branches. What was it for the Green New Deal? 128?
128, yeah.
Which is a huge number, right? It's very big, very popular, and very radical. Demands. And this is the first time that's happened. So I do think the dynamic's different now. The challenge is keeping that dynamic in place. So instead of it just being, you know, here's the leadership, they come up with good ideas, we clap along, there's a much more, it's more of a dialogue at least between leadership and membership. And that I think is much more useful in terms of winning a Labour government and winning a Labour government with an actually radical agenda that can do something. By the way, we're not going to win if it doesn't have a radical agenda that's going to do something. I think that should be very clear to everyone by now, but seemingly is not.
Yeah, and I think one point to add to that is that for me, it has so much legs because it's not just membership and leadership collaborating, but also, you know, the crowding in of all the unions. So the Green New Deal motion, for example, although, you know, everyone's aware of a somewhat fraught process in arriving at a final motion, you know, ultimately we had the backing on conference floor of seven unions, including those that represent, you know, oil and gas industry workers, backing, you know, the rapid phase out of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So it's a tremendous sort of groundswell that spans all aspects of the party.
Yeah, I mean, I want to come on to the kind of process of the kind of evolution of the Green New Deal, both among both in the initial campaign and at conference itself. But I just wonder, you know, in terms of the kind of longer term implications of this stuff, you know, it struck me this year at the World Transformed, which is the for listeners who don't know, which is the fringe festival generated kind of by you know, people who are part of the Corbynite influx to the party. Really kind of strong emphasis this year on policy, but on participatory policy making as well. And so trying to think through some of the ideas, like very seriously. And I mean, you know, so part of Novara's presence there meant that I got to see less than I would like in those places. And it meant that one would sort of drop in for 5 minutes here and there and sort of see the stuff that's going on. But it seemed very clear to me that there was quite a serious conversation going on there about the kind of policy that we would want to see. And it, you know, obviously it was very clear that the Shadow Treasury was certainly open to that kind of process. Do you have a sense that the Labour Party itself is a little kind of bemused by the sudden arrival of these kind of bottom-up policy campaigns?
Well, it shouldn't be by this point. I mean, this has been quite a long time coming. It's 2015 that Jeremy got elected leader. It's 2015 that there's the surge in membership. It was two, really. It was 2015 and 2017 around and just after the election. That's now sort of stabilised and institutionalised itself, partly outside of the formal structures of the Labour Party. The various campaigns that got this to move are not like part of the Labour Party institution. They were set up independently by members, which is a very good thing. It's the same with the World Transformed. It's a very good institution to have. It is not part of the Labour Party as such, and I think that's a very useful, it's not really a tension, but it's quite a creative tension, let's say, to have between the structure and the necessary organisation of a large political party and a bunch of people who want to do something and have ideas and want to create a different way of thinking about how we address politics. I think that's a very useful thing to have, and you see it coming through in the World Transformed, particularly this year, I thought.
I mean, one of the things that I think is quite, I suppose, it's quite unusual within the Labour Party, because it's a very strong, I mean, I used to say this about the Labour Party all the time, is like, you know, one of the real problems with the Labour Party is like the instinct of its membership is always to kind of absolutely trust its leadership, even where that leadership is not trustworthy. In this case, I think the leadership is far better than the leaderships that the Labour Party has had in the past. But it seems to me, you know, that this is a real step forward in that sense of saying, like, okay, well, actually we can, you know, develop these things ourselves, and also, you know, actually try to push the leadership a bit on these matters. I think that was particularly clear in some of the motions on free movement, which I'm not sure were going to be particularly congenial to some of the more paranoid members of the leadership team. But anyway, I mean, you know, lots of the politically engaged parts of the left are very happy about the policy outcomes from this conference, and I think that's good. If you listen to lobby journalists, which one shouldn't always do, they tend to maintain that policy has very little effect on how people actually vote. And they say things like, well, it's actually the Remain-Leave split that will decide the coming election, and that indeed that it was responsible for the 2017 vote share that the Labour Party achieved. Is that true?
Who wants to take that? Do you want to?
I can take it. Well, I think, I mean, there's definitely a grain of truth to that. But I think what's so exciting about what's come out of this conference in particular is that, you know, rather than sort of policy wonk and highly technical announcements that are, you know, really important and often very exciting, but ultimately not particularly sexy or tangible, precisely because these are policies that have come from non-policy types, that have come from the grassroots, I think my belief is that they will resonate much more powerfully than, you know, announcements that come from the party machinery itself. So I think it definitely has the capacity to create that kind of radical, exciting vision that does cut through the Brexit noise to some extent.
I agree with that. I mean, I think if people are telling you that policy doesn't really matter, they're living in the past. They're living in the 1990s when, you know, everything is communication, everything is optics. Look, in the world we're in now, post 2008, particularly, I think probably post around, you know, 2010, 2015, it is absolutely policy that matters. Why did Donald Trump win? In the end, he won. Okay, he gamed the system and gamed it rather successfully, and Hillary Clinton was a useless candidate with a worse campaign, but he gamed the system on the basis of policy. He was going to do something. It was going to be big and dramatic. It may be stupid and awful and frankly racist, but he was going to do something. Not just build the wall and tear up NAFTA, but also like going to places out in Rust Belt America, out in Michigan, and saying, look, you want investment here, I'm going to build you the bridge you've been crying out for, that sort of thing. Drawing a big list of all the investments he's going to make. This is policy. This is big, dramatic policy. It works. Boris Johnson has got that. He only has one thing, really, and it is Brexit, which is a policy. It may not be much of a policy, because he doesn't really say anything beyond, we're going to do a Brexit, but it is a policy, and it's big and it's clear. Unless Labour gets something also big and clear, we will not win this one. In the world we live in now, policy is what counts much more than communications, much more than the so-called optics. I mean, in conventional sort of political terms, Trump's optics are awful, right? He's just bad at these things. Boris Johnson keeps losing stuff. He turns up his hair all over the place. This is bad. This is not Tony Blair circa 1996, right? But he's still doing well because of this, because he's very clear. It doesn't matter what he looks like. It doesn't matter if he loses in Parliament. He is going to do this thing that you want. Unless Labour gets something similar, big and bold and dramatic, and makes it very clear that we're going to do this, we aren't going to beat Boris Johnson. That's the simple truth of this one.
Strong. I mean, it's striking, actually. I mean, that I was reading, of all things, a Marina Hyde piece, the kind of sort of standard piece she writes about Labour Party conference every year, which said, they're all mad! mad. They're all mad.
She's so funny.
But what's startling is that even in that piece, it was almost as if it could have been written beforehand, right? And it probably was. it had, you know, just twice in the piece, it was like, it also has some interesting policy, which is being overshadowed by this. It's sort of like, this is, and it's such a placeholder. But even in that, there's an acknowledgement that there's something going on here. And obviously, the worst thing in the world for Marina Hyde would be to engage with policy, although I'm sure if she did, she'd do it in a rather predictable way. But it's definitely there. It's definitely there. And it seems to me that it cuts through, you know, to use that dreadful phrase that lobby journalists like a lot, but cuts through even to people like, you know, in a very kind of biased and obviously right-wing way. I didn't see it because, of course, I don't watch Question Time because I'm not a masochist, but I saw circulating this morning this question on Question Time, which is, philosophers say that envy is bad. Is Labour's policy to steal people's property motivated by envy? You think, okay, but this is you know, this is already a kind of, you know, however kind of warped and bizarre, it's a political conversation about the kind of things people want to do with the country. So it does seem to me that there is, you know, there is something.
Who are these philosophers?
I don't know.
I've been wondering all morning about it, because I saw the question. You think, well, who is this philosopher that says
the seven deadly sins?
I guess it's Aquinas, isn't it?
Well, there you go. Okay. Yeah,
for a return to scholasticism.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
Finally.
But it does seem to me that the environment is there for it. And I guess the question is how you make policy into a kind of political argument, right? So how you communicate it. You know, over the top of, you know, okay, well, you know, we want X percent here and, you know, whatever. How's the Green New Deal thinking about doing that?
That's a good question and something that is constantly in development. I think what we've done, at least thus far, is create something that is fundamentally simple. There's nothing in it that you can't relate to as a non-policy person. And it's because it's come out of people that recognize problems in their lives and recognize ways they want to address them and who care about climate and recognize that climate is linked with all of those other issues. And so there's nothing in it that's fantastically technical. And I think as long as we continue to communicate that, then the technical wonkery can happen in the background. But, you know, we see our role very much as operating separately to that sphere, and, you know, building the movement and the support to allow for that technical policymaking process to happen.
Well, because the argument often with climate change politics is that this stuff is abstruse, it doesn't connect to people and how they really live their lives. Is that true?
I mean, fundamentally, no, in terms of, you know, climate does affect people's lives. It is affecting people's lives. I think prior till now, maybe people did sort of feel that it was, you know, separate to their daily existence. But I think what has been tremendous for me over the past, you know, even year or two is watching people very successfully and very effectively connect climate, you know, with class issues and with our economic system, and doing so in a way that is incredibly compelling, you know, as evinced by the most recent conference where, you know, the CLP submitting the Green New Deal dwarfed all other motions. People recognize the links between these things and between their daily lives.
No, I completely agree with that. And I think that's the key to making this work, or in a certain sense, a key to understanding what class politics would look like in conditions where climate change is a real thing. You have to talk about the climate as a class issue. I wish I'd coined the line, but environmentalism without class politics is just gardening, right? So we have to sort of get beyond this idea of sort of, you know, hand-wringing and talking about the poor little puffins or whatever. I mean, I do feel sorry for the poor little puffins. I really would not like to see them go extinct, but there's kind of bigger systemic issues here. By the way, the Tories have got the gardening point of environmentalism ever since Michael Gove, who I hate to mention on Navarra, but Michael Gove was Environment Secretary back in 2017. They quite deliberately zeroed in on environmental issues and a certain version of environmental issues, right, which is framing it as conservation. Mm-hmm. So framing it as like, let's get rid of plastic straws, what about the poor little puffins, or name some other, you know, endangered seabird. These aren't bad things to do. It's just that you're missing the wider systemic issue. And once you talk about a systemic issue, you have to drag class politics into this. We have to get to the point where talking about the environment is also doing something that I think is critical to political success in the kind of society and wider political environment we're in, which is you have to name an enemy. You have to say who you... you're not going to sit there and saying, oh, it's all going to be motherhood and apple pie and everything's going to be great and we're going to create so many green jobs and it's going to be wonderful. People want to know where the costs are going to land, and we have to make it absolutely clear. The costs land the 1%. The costs land on the people running and who own our oil companies. The costs land on the polluters. That's where it's going to end up. Once we do that, you turn environment into a class issue and you have the licence then to go and talk about what we might do instead that's better. But until we get that right, I think it's going to be a little bit too much like, well, that's something the unions quite rightly say. They don't want pie-in-the-sky promises about jobs, right? They don't want to just be told, oh, it's all going to be fine, you know, no need to worry about it. Well, hang on a minute, actually, this will involve changes. So who's going to bear the cost for it? Let's not have ordinary working people bear the cost. Let's shove the cost of the transition onto the 1%. That's the kind of line that I think Labour needs to be adopting on this.
We should send that to like the communications unit. This seems obviously true to me. Like there does seem to be, you know, just on the other side of this as well. Of course, people talk about, you know, and it's often a kind of Labour Party cliche. It's like, how do you communicate this on a doorstep? Well, it does seem to me that recently. Oh, that was an odd impression. I don't know what that came.
I loved it.
It does seem to me that recently there has been, I mean, you know, it's in some ways, you know, there's been a spate of climate change related phenomena. Obviously, the most recent one, you know, you've got the Whaley Bridge stuff, you know, the hugely, you know, dangerous summer heat. Mm-hmm. You know, this stuff does seem to be, you know, tangible in a way that it wasn't necessarily in the past. My fear, of course, is that there is, you know, there is a reactionary construction that can be put on this stuff, as kind of James is saying, which is, you know, and I was sort of glad to see like some very, very solid confrontation with, you know, a possible green politics, which is limited to the borders of one single nation, right? That I think is part of the thing that made it actually so successful. A policy motion was that it recognised that there's a global context to this stuff. Let's talk about it properly then and jump into the Green New Deal in a bit of detail. Just because it was starting, we ran an event on Sunday evening, the Navarra Media Radical Variety Show, all 2 hours of which are up on YouTube, and you can pop along and see a very exciting series of interviews, games, etc., including John McDonald spinning the wheel of public ownership. you know, one of our contestants on the Left Island event, a kind of blind date, was in a Green New Deal t-shirt, and the response from the crowd and the chanting in the crowd for a Green New Deal was astonishing. Mm. Now, obviously, it's a Labour Party conference, and obviously, anything run by us is going to appeal to a certain stratum of Labour Party membership, but I didn't expect it actually to be so kind of vociferous. Just tell me a little bit about the kind of Green New Deal policy framework and how it came about, because it seems to have gone on a kind of interesting transatlantic journey from, you know, Anne Pettifor through the United States and sort of back here.
So I guess, I mean, it's done exactly that. So about a decade ago, Anne Pettifor sat down with the Green New Deal group and wrote up a set of principles in the wake of the financial crisis intended to address what they saw as, you know, trouble crises of inequality, the financial crisis, and climate. For, you know, various reasons we could delve into, but I won't here today, that didn't necessarily pick up at the time, until it was sort of dug out of the ashes again by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the United States, where it has sort of gained a lot of momentum, although also a lot of fierce resistance and criticism. And I will say that also Bernie Sanders sort of has an equivalent. It's a much less flashy Green New Deal plan rather than a single relatable motion. It's, I think, a 33-page policy document that really gets at the meat of it, which is perhaps why it's less well-known. But I think since then, what we've tried to do is really capitalize on what we saw as an incredible moment where suddenly these linked issues were emerging again. And so our motion was built out of both the original Green New Deal and with some inspiration from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's and the Sunrise movements. Although it is, you know, there are some differences. So for us, in the UK context, we chose to put in what became the very contentious 2030 decarbonisation target. And that sort of links to the internationalism aspect of it that you're talking about. So that is, you know, that stems from our recognition of the necessity of, you know, having an internationalist focus with this, particularly in light of the UK's colonial history and imperial present, and our outsized contribution to global emissions. So that's sort of the footing that we started from, and from which all other principles flowed.
I just, maybe you can just run down, so you mentioned the 2030 target there, which is obviously sort of controversial during during conference and during the way in which the motion came to the floor. Just give us a quick rundown of some of the other major policy limbs.
Yeah, so so first we have sort of our net zero by 2030 target, but we also talk a lot about expanding democratic public ownership, particularly of key services like energy and transport, water. We talk about the provision of universal basic services, a lot of which, you know, the party has already sort of adopted, so a national food service or education or energy as a human right. And we also talk about, principles of internationalism based in solidarity rather than charity, as well as creating protections for migrants, as well as staunchly supporting measures that support the right to stay, so that we can prevent people from being forced to leave their homes in the first place. And that sort of covers off the gist of it, I guess.
Just on the 2030 stuff, I think I think it's quite well known that this was a matter of some controversy between the campaign and the unions. But actually, one of the things that I think was most striking, so the way that the motion passed on the floor of conference was that usually the Labour Party, if there's a motion coming, there's a compositing meeting in which various interest groups within the party get together and try to hammer out something that's satisfactory, negotiated between all of them. Some of the trade unions had an issue with the target, and I know there was a lot of back and forth on that. But what was striking to me actually was that so therefore two motions came to the floor, one with the target, one without, some other slight differences between them. But one of the things I think that was most striking was the level of trade union support for both motions, actually.
Yeah.
And actually, within the context of the British Labour movement, that's actually quite a shift. If you'd been looking a decade ago to say, what's British socialism's position on climate change, it would be not my problem. That's a bit of a caricature, but it's not completely out of the realm of reason. There used to be a lot of conversation about sort of balanced energy policy and very much protecting kind of or very hesitant about tackling fossil fuel and extractive industry. But I think this is signals a move away from that in a positive way. Has there, how have you been thinking about keeping the Labour movement on board?
So that sort of underpins everything we do. So from the outset, we've always said that this can't just come from us, that the motion is intended to be constantly dynamic and in flux and, welcomes input from and leadership from the trade unions. And so that sort of is the fundamental premise of what we do. So, the way that the motion eventually came off the floor was that it's no longer just achieve net zero by 2030. The phrasing, which I'm really pleased with, is that, achieving net zero by 2030, provided that it is done in a way that has, workers and trade unions at the helm, that is in a way that they have designed, they have signed off on, and that in no way sort of penalizes them. And so that really gets to the core of the Green New Deal, which is that this isn't just a climate policy. This is a much broader economic transformation, and one that is rooted in principles of labor and in socialism.
I mean, it's funny in some ways, isn't it? Because the strength of the British working class emerged, coeval with and as part of their access to coal. It's one of the things that made sections of the working class so strong was that it could effectively cut off industries which depended absolutely on this. So it does seem to me that there's something to be learnt there from that history. James, this does signal, doesn't it, quite a significant change within the orientation of the British Labour movement?
I think so. And you're absolutely right. There's an absolutely fantastic book by Andreas Malm called Fossil Capital, which I'd very strongly recommend people read, on precisely that history, the twin development of capitalism as such, but capitalism in Britain, industrial capitalism in Britain in particular, but also the development of a labour movement and how the two things have kind of marched together through time. Now, this is rather a sweeping claim, but what's interesting at the minute is these things are becoming detached, right? that there is a potential for a labour movement to not have that relationship to what Malm quite rightly calls fossil capital, that we see something else quite different emerging, and potentially quite a sort of anti-capitalist formation appearing there. But what I'd say on top of that, though significant though it is to get in particular the huge vote for the 2030 target on conference, is that there is a distance between what conference, this is historically what always happens in the Labour Party, there is a distance between what conference says and what actually turns up in a manifesto, let alone what a Labour government actually does somewhere down the line. The critical issue here with an election bearing down as presumably, although not guaranteed, but presumably quite soon, is what goes in the manifesto. And I think the challenge is to make sure that we can get to a good, solid, credible commitment at or around 2030. The wording in the motion is, you know, working towards 2030. So let's get to a good, solid, credible commitment that we have the unions on board, and let's get that in the manifesto. Because the point of the 2030 at or around 2030 is it forces the pace of what you're doing. You move from a world in which you're saying, 2050, basically you don't do anything. Well, everything carries on much as it is. 2040, okay, maybe there's a bit of acceleration. I mean, I think some of the car companies complain if you start talking about 2040 away, because they have to kind of shift to electric vehicles a bit faster than they'd like. There's a cost to them for doing that. At 2030, you have to be really serious about you're going to change things. You're going to have to create a million green jobs. You're going to have to completely restructure how the economy of this country operates to the benefit of working people. This means places that haven't had real investment for 40 years are suddenly going to get it, because you're going to be building wind farms. You're going to be employing people to build those wind farms. You're going to be transforming how we work and how we live. That's the kind of offer that starts to make sense. That's the kind of offer that starts to cut through all the nonsense around Brexit and all the nonsense that the government and the Tories are going to try and put out there. It has to be that sort of thing that's radical enough to make a difference and to be a clear vision of what the future might look like. So that's why the 2030 target really, really matters, just in terms of trying to win the next election. I think unless it's quite radical, unless we really do push the boat out and make a clear, radical proposal that offers benefits to people, that sets a target on an enemy, the top 1%, and says this is what it's going to look like once we've, you know, changed how the economy operates, that, I think, is the only way we're going to get cut through presumably in what? It'll be November the 5th at the very earliest is the election, legally the election can be this time.
Yeah, see, I mean, the thing you're saying there is about the Clause 5 meeting, right? So this is a meeting in which the Labour Party's manifesto is decided, which only has certain actors in the room. And so I think it's quite essential to figure out, you know, how... It does seem to me that much more so than some of the other motions that have been passed by conference, so, for instance, the motions on sort of private education, I think are far likelier to be rather diluted in a Clause 5 meeting. It does seem to me that the huge pressure and enthusiasm is going to be kind of key to keeping it in there. Do you have any sense of how you're going to try to keep the pressure up, as it were, on the leadership, which is presumably something that organised socialists are going to or should be thinking about doing?
Yeah. So the structure of the Green New Deal, you know, Labour for a Green New Deal campaign is that, you know, we have this motion, yes, but much more than that, this has been about building political support and capacity in a movement. So we're not just, you know, six kids sitting in a room talking policy, although we do that. It's, you know, dozens of groups that have been organized around the country, you know, galvanizing support for this issue. So that will be a huge part of it. You know, we have a big public-facing and widespread support across the country. But also importantly, aside from the 2030 target, the most phenomenal outcome of the conference for me was that, aside from that, we have two motions that are virtually identical and equally radical in their scope. You know, you have the largest oil and gas representing union, as I said before, not only calling for rapidly phasing out fossil fuels, but for doing so, you know, in line with the IPCC 1.5 report. Like, that is a phenomenal change from the landscape just 2 years ago. And I think, you know, party leadership, if they don't recognize that, they absolutely should, in addition to the clear public support that it's already garnered.
Just want to, you know, maybe head off at the pass some of the things. So I sort of saw some of the reaction to Green New Deal motion passing, you know, and sort of tried to gather a nice florilegium of sort of nonsense from its opponents. So it's impossible, it's unscientific, it's against business, cap and trade is good, market-based solutions, socialism by the back door, and there's risks.
It's not socialism by the back door, it's socialism by the front door.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite clear about that.
But what sense do you have of you know, of what the opponents of change on this are going to throw at you?
You missed the one where they called me a loon in the Financial Times. That was my personal favorite. It was good. As a Canadian, I felt, you know, a strong resonance with that. I think, you know, we're very aware of all of the arguments that you've come up with, because frankly, none of them are new or particularly interesting. I think what has changed is that, you know, people have always said, oh, tackling climate change is too expensive. We don't know how we're going to do it. But finally, we have something that is a compelling solution that people can rally behind. And that is a first, I think. And so just by passing this motion, we, as James said before, we've completely changed the frame of what we're talking about as within the realm of possibility. You know, 2030 will define, you know, everything else about our economic and political agenda. You can't do anything really that wouldn't conform to that. And so just by setting that ambition, you know, we change the frame of what we can do altogether.
And just in terms of kind of implementation, which would be a nice thing to be thinking about rather than getting to the point of implementation in the first place, which of course is what everyone's mind should be bent towards at the motion. But if you look beyond where, you know, the immediate horizon, you know, do you have a sense of where the major social and political obstacles are going to be in the longer term? And I think there are some obvious things here. Finance capital, obviously, you know, big. You know, petrol companies. These are, you know, people, you know, people who love their greenwash. These are all obviously true. I wonder about, you know, whether you see legal challenges to some of this stuff. You know, I know that you spend a lot of time thinking about the relationship of these like rather unpleasant pieces of capital to climate change. What's your sense of how they might fight back against it?
Oh, God, forecasting the future. I think, yeah, I mean, it will be a fight. Everything that we're doing is about redistributing wealth and power from, you know, the cabal in which it currently sits and into the hands of, you know, the working people. So that will be a fierce battle. And I think all the culprits that you've named will be present in it. You know, it's sort of an obvious answer, but, you know, finance capital will push back against this. Businesses will push back against this. You know, the CBI was one of the people coming out saying there's absolutely no credible pathway. But, you know, we are prepared for that. And I think when you have, you know, groundswell of support from not only this party membership, but from industry, and in particular, I'll harp on it again, the trade unions, you can push that kind of resistance when they are the people driving the agenda. Mm-hmm.
Ruminating on some of the other parts that were likely to meet resistance and what the CBI and other groups might say about that. I mean, you have to put it, I think, also the 2030 and the Green New Deal target in the context of some of the other stuff that was passed and both supported from the platform by John McDonnell, which is the four-day week. Mm. Now, at this point, you know, if you're saying a four-day week by 2030 and net zero at or around 2030, then suddenly this is a vision of a radically different economy and society about a decade from now. I mean, that's quite something, right? And developing a clear pathway to that is, all right, partly a technical process of what, particularly on the decarbonisation side, what is it that we actually have to do? Where can these jobs be made and all the rest of it? But I think there's also this political part of trying to drive this into every single town and city in the country, that this is something you're part of, that we need a vision that works from the bottom up. You know, you get Rebecca Long Bailey talking about a green industrial revolution. Well, it has to be a revolution from below. It has to be something where, you know, there are local councils, there are local groups, there are local activists able to say, actually, this is what it looks like if we're moving our town or our city towards a net zero carbon target. It has to sort of come together like this. That, I think, is how you start to break through some of what is likely to be resistance at the very top of society that I think we can already see appearing. That once you get the politics from below, once you start to deliver this from below, that's when you open up more a wider space of possibility of change.
Local assemblies, yay, my favourite thing.
Local councils are looking at
No.
Yourself,
I mean,
you know,
I
serious levers.
I think you're right.
It.
I think it's like the only plausible pathway to this. The reason I was thinking of this is I was doing a session with Richard Seymour at the World Transformed, and we were talking a bit about the, you know, democratic crisis and political change, and how you would want to sort of change the way in which we do politics in this country, and how it needs to change and how it's broken. And one of the things he said, and I think is completely right, is that if you were to take climate change seriously, then that requires an overhaul in the way that you think about democracy entirely. Because in order to make the kind of sweeping change that you need to make, you have to have, you know, functioning and local democratic consent to this stuff. You have to really bring, frankly, the whole country on board. It's the kind of enormous change that is usually required in like a war effort, That's I don't mean kind of command and control here. I mean the kind of rebuilding that's done like immediately post-war, either on either side, frankly. And so I guess, you know, this is a sort of route into the sort of, you know, other question that I have here, which is that obviously one of the critiques that's made of the Labour Party and its kind of immediate post-war strategy is that its sense of a strategic vision of public ownership is often like pretty haphazard, and was pretty haphazard. So like the kind of post-45 nationalisations were often kind of articulated as a mode of rationalisation, a kind of extension of sort of welfare capitalism. Like, you know, so often they were accused of, you know, or explicitly defended as kind of socialization of loss, right? These industries aren't working. We need to bring them into, you know, national control. You know, there was very, you know, much less thought put to like the mode of ownership itself. So you're reaching for these kind of deficitary industries rather than thinking about, you know, how these things function strategically in terms of an overall vision. And one, you know, the flip side, you know, or indeed, you know, an extension to that is that, you know, very often when things were nationalised, the mode by which they operated didn't change very profoundly. Mm-hmm. You know, the National Coal Board is like the key example of this. It brings like some lords, some treasury people in, and so it essentially functions as, you know, with the state as the boss instead of the boss as the boss. And then when you've got those things in, you know, the kind of post-45 programme, you have the 1949. You know, arguments and, you know, really kind of bizarre grab bag of things to nationalize, including like sugar, you know, which was not implausible at the time, but you ended up in a, you know, without being able to articulate why that was a key part of what you were doing, you ended up in a kind of PR war with Tate and Lyle's Mr. Cube crusade to defend the sugar cube.
Thomas Cook as well, wasn't it?
Yes.
Thomas Cook was nationalised for a period of time and then privatised by Edward Heath in the early 1970s. But anyway,
that went well.
Yep.
So I guess, like, and I suppose, you know, how do you articulate a strategic vision coming out of this conference around the Green New Deal, like touching on some of that stuff, right? Touching on actually the way in which, you know, it needs to not just be this kind of centralised. Or rather, you know, inarticulate sense of nationalisation.
I think it's a very good question, and for me, it starts to look like if you're building on the idea of a green industrial revolution from below, then this is why the worker ownership stuff really matters. Mm-hmm. That you give people the capacity to change how the company and firm they work for operates, or how the asset that they own, that they will now own, is actually going to be run. I mean, part of that is saying things like, well, look. We want lots of wind farms everywhere. The quick way to do this is give local communities ownership of it, because that tends to, you know, erode any opposition people have, because suddenly it's a thing you own. And if you think about where you might build them, you know, take the Welsh Valleys or somewhere, places that are really not seen very much in the way of meaningful investment for a very, very long period of time. Suddenly this is a lever to like change the economy, the local economy and how it operates there. But it has to be done on the basis of a kind of local ownership, local control. And you can apply that more generally to how we own and run our businesses. That once you get out of what we have in particular in Britain is a pretty short-term, very narrowly focused shareholder value view of how a company should operate. Once you start to crack that open, once you say, here are all these other things that a company could be doing, that we have lots and lots of productive things that we are now going to take ownership and control over, and we're doing it on a decentralised basis, then you can start to build together the map or the plan on a local basis towards what 2030 looks like. Part of it, I think, has to be it has to be some degree of central sort of targeting. And if you take the really big changes around how, you know, we're going to transform the whole energy system, it has to look like some central, basically, command and control at that point. It has to. But a lot of it, and in fact, probably most of it in practice, is going to have to come from below. So the worker ownership stuff fits very, very neatly, I think, with the idea of a Green New Deal. Not only as like, here is government, it will give you a 2030 target, here you go, that's your thing, but something that you have a collective ownership of. Hegemony, I think, is the word, or possibly hegemony, depending on and where you sit in that one, is the word you're looking for. That you have to build these things from below. You have to build the local support, and you have to get a sense that there is an entire country moving towards doing this, and not just, here's your government, here's some nice things for you.
Yeah, and I'll add that's what's so exciting about sort of the green energy transition in particular, is that, you know, in the post-war consensus, a part of the issue with, you know, centralized bureaucratic nationalization, particularly of things like the energy system, a lot of that, you know, you almost can't be blamed for, because how do you have decentralized management of a gas-fired power plant or a coal mine? You can't really. But in you know, a renewable energy revolution, you know, these energy sources lend themselves by design to decentralization, to community ownership and management. And so, you know, it's almost in the DNA of what we're asking to do is avoiding those kinds of pitfalls.
Yeah, I mean, historically, there was obviously a really a real hesitance among the sort of party leadership, and indeed even its kind of intellectual layer, of anything that looked a bit syndicalist, right? So, you know, nothing that had sort of, you know, reasonable or kind of meaningful like workers' control. So, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, even when you have, like, you know, absolutely left-wing intellectuals, Barbara Whitton, Evan Durbin, the Webbs, they're thinking about kind of, you know, socialist planning, stuff like that. But actually worker ownership is something that they're very, very hesitant about. That does seem to me to be changing within the contemporary Labour Party. It does seem to me to be now at the kind of front and centre.
Changing and ironically driven from the top, I think, in this case. But changing. Because, look, both John and Jeremy don't really come from that tradition, right? They come from a place in the Labour movement that was always much closer to what you've called syndicalism, but this kind of idea of workers' control, in fact, the Institute for Workers' Control, of R.H. Tawney, of G.D.H. Cole, of these sort of figures that tended to be pushed and were pushed, particularly in the post-war period, to the edges of what the Labour Party was struggling for and what the Labour movement stood for, which was it ended up with a very sort of centralised view of how you're going to introduce socialism one way or the other. There's a number of sort of strands that feed into this. I mean, I tend to blame the Fabians for not the contemporary Fabians, but the historic Fabians, let's be nice, for this sort of thing, that kind of liblabism, this sort of crossover with a particular sort of liberal view of the world in which the nice people will be in charge and they'll make nice things happen, combined with the sort of Herbert Morrison view of how you nationalise things. It's basically just, you know, you have a big corporation and there are civil servants and they'll tell you what to do. Thank you very much. We're the masters now, as whichever minister it was infamously said in the 45 Labour government. Well, actually, let's not have that. Let's say you're the masters now, I think is probably the attitude we want to get to. And we have to. This is the kind of exciting bit. This is the bit where you start to see how the world might be different, how the economy certainly could be different. Is that the technologies we're talking about now, in particular renewable technology, lends itself to this form of organisation of necessity. But not just that. If you look at, you know, the kind of way in which scale is disappearing as an issue in manufacturing, not completely, but you can see how you can do really quite advanced manufacturing on a small scale. Take the plan to sort of insulate every loft in the country, right, which employs, you know, 200,000 people, I think, is the estimate for it. It's a great idea. It means people saving their heating bills and you massively reduce carbon emissions from people's houses. But to do that, you're going to have to do something, particularly with like the weirdly shaped old houses we have in this country. You're going to have to do something like batch production, small-scale production of loft insulation, right? Now, that can now be done at an economic scale in a way it couldn't have been done, say, 10 years ago. Or 3D printing, if you want to get into the Aaron Bastani kind of end of things. But seriously, these things matter. Like, suddenly, scale disappears as an economic issue, or it starts to look like that. And that means you can have meaningful, local, decentralised, collective ownership of these assets and therefore build an economy that looks very, very different to the one we're used to.
I love it when it gets granular. I love it when there's like a really kind of interesting, concrete like thing that you begin to feel and think and see how things could be different. I think that's actually really important. And, you know, it's something that those of us who have more theoretical tendencies can often miss. But I wanted to talk a little bit because one of the things we've been saying is actually how much there is a kind of single garment being woven here, right? Like that actually, you know, policies that are being passed by the Labour Party that are making it their way to the kind of centre of left-wing political conversation actually seem to cohere into a single vision. I wonder if you have a sense of any of the other policies that were passed at conference which struck you as particularly important or particularly exciting. I know there's been very little coverage of some of these, for instance. You know, one of the ones that was striking to me, for instance, was the pharmaceutical policy, which was announced in the leader's speech. You know, that's the kind of thing that seems really important, maybe a little dry, but, you know, essential to so many people in this country. I think it's dry to political journalists, you know, largely because political journalists are generally pretty terrible. But what do you make of the other stuff that's come out of conflicts?
Well, that's huge. I mean, that's the thing that like, is really strikingly large. I mean, this is sort of the bringing into public ownership of medical research in Britain. That's kind of what it implies. Along with, we're going to set up a kind of publicly owned generic drugs producer and supply like cheap drugs to the NHS and indeed the rest of the world. I mean, this is the kind of extraordinary free gift that you can suddenly create, that you can cut out the profiteering of pharmaceutical companies and take the intellectual property that they have and turn it into something that will make a massive difference potentially to millions of lives. Now, this is huge. It's also doing something interesting that we haven't until this point, once Jeremy took over as leader, hadn't really got into, which is a question around who owns intellectual property and various sets of issues around intellectual property. We tend to talk about ownership as being kind of the physical things that you might have. You know, so here's your wind farm, you own it. Here's the, whatever else. Trying to think, electricity infrastructure, national grid, we all own it. Railways, we all own it. That sort of thing. So you talk about the physical stuff rather than like what actually is critically important to how the economy operates, which is the intellectual property, the knowledge of how you do these things. And it suddenly cracks into that. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant announcement. It really starts to push the pace of what you want to do. It's an obvious material benefit. You can save the NHS a great deal of money because of this, and you can do this big, dramatic gesture for the rest of the world, which I think says something about the kind of society we'd want to live in. I must say, I also pay tribute to my old colleagues in the bit of work they've done this. The policy paper produced to back this up is one of the best things that's been produced since 2015, I think.
Yeah, and I'll add, I think what I saw as a trend coming out of it that was really exciting and very much in line with sort of Green New Deal principles is sort of a lot of the policies seem to get at tackling the commodification of things that should not be commodified. So, criminal justice is a really good example, a suite of reforms to how we do that, how we provide legal representation, eliminating sort of that commodification, as well as, a national food service. It's maybe less sexy than other policies, but that is huge. Ending right to buy, that's another, flagship, simple policy that gets to the heart of what we're trying to do, which is moving away from a private profit-driven model and towards sort of shared collective wealth.
I mean, it just seems to me, I mean, especially on this stuff and on pharmaceutical stuff in particular, but yes, you're right, the sense of decommodification is hugely important. I have, as a gay man, I have friends who depend for healthy functioning on antiretroviral drugs, cutting edge HIV medication, which is, there was the famous case in the United States of kind of price gouging on stuff like this, but more widely across the board, there is a sense, and it's less present in the UK because we have the NHS, but there is a sense among friends I have, what happens if those supplies are threatened? What happens in a situation in which these kinds of protections no longer exist? And it's pretty scary stuff, actually. And so I think, there's a really strong message there. And once something begins to be lifted out of commodification, as Britain has done with healthcare, once it started to be lifted out of commodification, then it's almost impossible for people to think that it should go back into commodity form. And that seems to me to connect with one of the arguments or one of the pieces of rhetoric that comes from the shadow treasury in particular, which is about effecting an irreversible change to the way in which these things are thought about.
It seems to upset people. I mean, the language is from quite deliberately borrowed from what the 1974 manifesto, the fundamental and irreversible shift in the balance of power in favour of working people and their families. And John sort of picked up on this. John McDonnell picked up on this and used it. And it inspired this great big clucking and squawking from certain sectors. What does he mean? Look, this is simple. The NHS is irreversible as of this point. If you want to get rid of the NHS, you have to do what the Tories are doing, which is basically wind it down and chop it up piecemeal, bit by bit. And that's what they've done, and that's what they've done for a long period of time. But the fundamental idea, exactly as you say, because it's universal, because everyone gets it, people are attached to the thing they don't want to see it got rid of. Something similar with schools. I mean, schools are free and have been for a long period of time. It'd be quite hard to actually, do the opposite of what the motion at conference said, which is make every school private, right? It's an expectation that you get this thing. You can do something, you can apply that more generally, I think, through the National Education Service. But once you've decommodified something, once you've taken it out of the market, people get used to that form of distribution, and that's where it becomes irreversible. That's what irreversibility means. It means something that will be incredibly difficult to unwind. All right, fundamentally, in the end, perhaps some point in the future, the NHS will be destroyed or people just change their minds on it. But basically, that isn't going to happen. We're back to Gramsci, I'm afraid. We're back to Gemini. We're back to the idea that you're doing something that's so fundamental. John had a really nice line in it, which was sinking roots so deep that they can never be torn out, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you're doing. You're not writing a law. You're not just whatever fantasies various commentators have about what irreversibility means. You're doing something that's organically linked to the society we live in, so much so that people who live here would never, ever want to see it removed.
Excellent. I just wanted to touch also on something that you said, Adrienne, about the suite of criminal justice reforms, which I think are kind of hugely important. It's been kind of a bit of a weak plank in terms of Labour's relationship to this stuff so far. Sort of public accountability laws, abolition of sentences under 6 months, trying to provide kind of community law centres and community lawyers. Now, access to justice is something that's so hugely important and it really is one of the features of the coalition government and the austerity governments that's less remarked upon than it should be. But access to legal services, I mean, the legal profession, there are many windbag lawyers on the internet and whatever, the legal profession and the ethics of the legal profession are hugely, hugely important. And they're creaking. They're creaking under the pressure of an incredibly ill-financed system. Obviously for me, it's never just about reversing austerity, but transforming the way in which we think about these things. But reversing it is a good first step. I want to move on just for our last 10 minutes to some kind of more immediate political questions, which I think are important, because we've been coming out of conference, with this kind of sense, actually. And it's great, actually, in some ways, because I went into conference feeling a bit low, to be honest. I think that's true of everyone. And in some ways, the lightning bolt that descended from Brenda Hale on the Supreme Court helped sort of reanimate conference a bit. But I also felt that the engine for, getting people enthused again was the kind of strong policy change. It does seem to me that since conference has ended, we've sort of slid back a bit into this rather unpleasant and rather limited focus on Parliament. I just wonder if you have a sense of how much this civil war stuff within the party and this kind of parliamentary, shenanigans matters, and, whether it can have what I worry about is that it has a detrimental effect on keeping, the brightness and the sheer energy and frankly the optimism that this kind of policy change can induce.
Well, I mean, I've been to 4 party conferences now, and I approach every single one with a sense of dread and trepidation, because I think every single one has been preceded by, a summer of various sort of nonsense rows, and you come out of every single one feeling like, actually, we're on the right path and we can get somewhere with this, and this one was no exception, despite I think it's fair to call a somewhat unorthodox start to proceedings. The bit that gives you hope and optimism all this is like the size and scale of the ambition implied by the policy changes there, and the fact that so many people are so prepared to go out and fight for it. That's what the votes and conference floor looked like. I mean, forgetting it, Labour divisions. I didn't see a divided party in voting for a Green New Deal or supporting a 4-day week or ending freedom of movement. Where's the division? Like, you'd be hard pushed to find the damn thing. So this is sort of stuff and nonsense, and I tend to think that, broadly speaking, people tune out at stories about politicians fighting with each other. Where I do have a concern is, and this really does concern me, is that having been given this gift of the Supreme Court ruling with, sotto voce, some provisos attached to thinking that, the courts are going to rescue at any point in time. Let's park that thought. But with this gift from the Supreme Court, that we translate it back into exactly the parliamentary wrangling that Boris Johnson wants us to be having. There's no doubt about this. We can all say it's the optics. He looks terrible. He's been humiliated. 7 votes now. 7 votes taken, 7 votes lost in Parliament. Humiliated. He troops off. He tries to meet people on the street. He's humiliated and embarrassed there. That probably counts for a little bit more, actually. It's quite satisfying to watch. But broadly speaking, he's wandering around the place, losing everything, and it really does not matter. It particularly does not matter if where he's losing is Parliament, with a whole load of MPs queuing up and asking him to apologise. He's got the simple rule. In a polarised situation, never apologise, never explain. He's not going to do either. What we have to do, if we want to break out of this and not gift the next election to him, which I think is a serious risk here, is get out of that and talk about how we're going to change the world, how we're going to change this country. What are the big radical plans that we need to do that? Let's get Jeremy back out on the road. Let's fight this as if the election campaign is already starting. Let's get the rallies going. Let's get people out there talking about it and not fixate on a set of parliamentary manoeuvres. That is what Boris Johnson and his little Svengali want us to do. We need to do something different. If someone's trying to play like 5D chess or whatever the hell the metaphor is, kick over the table, do something else.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the most fatal flaw that the Labour Party could commit at this point is to get distracted, as James said, from everything else that happened at conference. Because, I mean, if you look at the coverage of conference, yeah, there was a bit about Brexit, but oh my God, for the first time in 6 months, you know, we had people, Piers Morgan was yelling about Eton instead of Brexit. Fantastic. Like, you know, that is a massive disruption. And I think we definitely need to capitalize on that energy. And I think it's not just the responsibility of the leadership. Absolutely, they need to not get sucked into the parliamentary games. But I think, you know, we as a membership or as a voter base need to continue with the incredible energy that I think all of us felt while we were there. And to continue forcing the hand to be away from prorogation and the pony show, as Ash likes to call it, towards substantive issues, the things that matter to people's lives, and the things that people really care about. You know, you have however many hundreds of thousands of people out striking again today. You had, you know, millions around the world last week about climate. We cannot forget that that is what people actually care about. That is what actually matters to people's lives. And so we have a responsibility to continue, you know, building upon that.
I mean, it does seem somehow to me that if the top of the party isn't going to do it, we're going to have to do it ourselves. Good socialist principle. But it does seem to me that this is necessary now. You know, for me, there is something quite striking, actually, about how hesitant the membership of the Labour Party has been to, you know, to move their hand without kind of, you know, even tacit consent from the top of the party. I think it's probably time to get over that. There is a danger, I think, also about this sort of, you know, focus on civility, this focus on language, this focus on, you know, people being rude. You know, this, you know, if nothing else, because surely we're going to have to be really, really, really rude to the people who own everything and whose you know interests that we're coming for. So concentration on civility. Although I hope I'm a reasonably civil person, it does seem to me to be a danger. And I think, you know, Dominic Cummings quoted from, you know, his speech at book launch last night saying, "We're enjoying this." Well, I think it's absolutely plausible that he is enjoying this, because actually, you know, he recognises that for him, a divided and polarised society is a good thing. I don't think, or it doesn't seem to me that the Labour Party can pretend that society isn't divided, but needs very clearly to draw a dividing line in a different place.
Yes, exactly. There's no use pretending society isn't polarised. It is. And at the minute, the polarisation that the government want and they're pushing hard for is basically Brexit versus everyone else. And if they get that polarisation, they will win. Right? That just let's take that as absolutely guarantee that they can do this. It will be still be a fight, and they may not get an outright majority, but they can get there if they do this. So we have to draw. We have to draw the polarity somewhere else. And that means getting out of talking about their preferred things, which is Brexit, 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 almost nothing else, and onto talking about our preferred things, which is how we're going to build just society and who it is that's going to pay for this. And it's going to be the 1%, and that's what we need to talk about. The polarization we need if we want to win has to work orthogonally. There you go. That's not a word I recommend using in the election pamphlet, but it has to work differently, cut across the polarization they want. If we can do that, if we can make this 1% versus 99%, the many versus the few, people versus privilege, then we're in with a shot of winning this one.
Yeah, I would disagree. I mean, I think it's in, you know, a farce to think that this won't be a fight. Absolutely, this will be a massive fight. And, you know, it's where we draw the line. We are launching a full assault on capital. That's what the Green New Deal is. And the key is bringing everyone with us without trying to even begin to have people on side whose wealth we're trying to, you know, redistribute in a way that is just. And, you know, we just can't get bogged down in doing that at all.
Labour for a Green New Deal, is it planning to start mobilising now?
Oh, we never stopped.
Excellent answer.
Yeah. Good. Okay, so, I mean, guess last question in a sentence, you know, what's the message that we want out there and to ram home?
Right. Okay. We are for the many, not the few. We are the 99% versus 1%. We are the people versus privilege. This is what matters. And you can pick which side you're on. You're either on the side of the elite or you're on the side of the people.
Oh, I think that's an incredible place to leave it. Obviously, Navarra Media has been at Labour Party conference throughout. That means that on the Navarra Media YouTube channel, on our homepage, you've got a lot of coverage, including some exciting live streams. Not only the a thrilling radical variety show, but lots of discussions, including one with James Medway, Steve Turner from Unite, and Sakina Sheikh, on, you know, discussing more of this kind of Green New Deal question. Obviously, we will be bringing you lots more exciting content over the next few days and weeks. This has been Novara FM on Resonance 104.4 FM. Adrienne, James, thank you so much for an excellent debrief show.
Thanks.
We will be back at the same time, in the same place, next week. Goodbye.
This show is brought to you by Novara Media. To find articles, videos, and more audio content like this, head to novaramedia.com. If you particularly enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen to it, why not head to iTunes? And as well as subscribing, leave us a review. Novara Media can only exist thanks to subscribers and supporters. If you have the means, please consider subscribing at support.novaramedia.com. As well as helping us continue to produce regular content, subscribers will also receive priority access to events as well as promotions throughout the year. For regular updates, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Novara Media. Media for a different politics.